You're listening to the Nightlife Podcast with Indira Naidu.
Why do birds sing in the morning? Why do birds have three eyelids? Why are some birds so colourful yet others are not? And why do the littlest birds sing the prettiest songs? At least according to these guys.
The littlest birds sing the prettiest songs. The littlest birds sing the prettiest songs. The littlest birds sing the prettiest songs. The littlest birds sing the prettiest songs.
That's the Be Good Tanyas with their song Littlest Birds. We're taking all those questions you've ever wanted to have answered about birds, anything at all. And the person who's going to help answer those questions is Dr. Gráinne Cleary. She's a Irish wildlife ecologist and research fellow at Deakin University and knows everything you would ever want to know about birds. And Gráinne's written a book that comes out next month. It's called Why Birds Do That. And that book answers over 50 questions of those most asked questions about bird behaviour. Gráinne, hello and welcome to Nightlife.
Hello, how are you going?
Very well. I absolutely adore the birds in my neighbourhood. So I'm really looking forward to tonight because there's so many things that I observe and I think, well, yeah, why do they do that? Now, you've got to tell us, where did this fascination, Gráinne, with birds develop?
Well, for me, I've always loved birds. So growing up in Ireland, they were probably the first the first bit of wildlife that caught my eye. But if you want to know about how did I get into them in Australia, well, it started with citizen science projects I was running when I lived up in Sydney. And the first one I ran was a koala count, where I had the public out counting the koalas for me to kind of get an idea of how many we have along the East Coast. And it was like pulling teeth. Nobody wanted to count the koalas. It was like this big media push, this big push to get people out, you know, into local parks, counting koalas. No, no. But, oh, my God, the next one I ran was looking at water, looking at how birds use water in backyards. Do people put out water? How many bird baths do they put out? Thousands of people joined up. People just went mad for it, wanted, you know, just loved it, just engaged with me so much. And that's where I really saw the passion people have for birds in Australia. And I absolutely fed off that because the birds over here have always blown me away since I first came over here. So I started looking at that and people would come up to me and email me and would be like, yeah, but what should we feed birds? Should we feed birds? And well, I do feed birds and this is what's happening. And it's quite a controversial subject in Australia, yeah. Feed birds. While in Ireland and the UK and the US, it's something that's very encouraged. But you've got to remember our land has been agriculture for a lot longer than Australia has been. But we've lost a lot of our birds. So seeing these bigger birds kind of adapting to urban areas in Australia and people wanting to give back, people wanting to interact with their bird was just absolutely fascinating for me. And it wasn't even big exotic birds. It was the birds like the magpies or even birds like the miners that people hate. And no matter what, you know, where you live, you know, if you live in the poorest area, of, you know, when you're in a council area, you're still going to get pigeons. Birds are always going to be with us, no matter where we live. And I just found that fascinating and how people just love their birds so much over here. I just got wrapped up in their passion.
Irish wildlife ecologist Dr. Gráinne Cleary is with me taking any question you have about birds. She's written a new book, Why Birds Do That. And we've got all the questions are coming thick and fast. This is going to be clearly a very popular topic. Daniel in Ryde, evening to you, Daniel.
Hello. I'm asking a question in regards to, like, the cockatoo bird. So here's the thing. I live in a specific area, and there are a lot of cockatoos that usually screech in the morning, and usually we have someone feeding the cockatoos. But, I also recently slept at my dad's house in a different area, and when I woke up at his house, the cockatoos there, they tend to make a beautiful cawing sound. You know the beautiful cockatoo sound, but
not the screech.
Not the screeching.
Yeah. So your question is why the difference in their screeching?
Yeah. Why is this so different when they wake up in the morning?
Yeah, Gráinne.
Okay. So one of the differences, now again, you know, I did write this book and I do a lot of research around birds, but there's always a disclaimer that, you know, we don't know everything about birds. So a lot of it is, you know, speculation. So what's happening there, I wonder, is the first thing you mentioned is that the birds were being fed in the area you grew up in or the area you lived in. So if you live in a more built up area and the cockatoos are being fed, they're probably being competitive against each other. So they'll be really screaming at each other, get out of my way, that's my bit of food, get out of here, that's mine, go away. You know, and they're really interacting with each other. But when you went to your dad's place, it might have been a more rural area where the cockatoos were more chilled and they were waking up and there wasn't that, you know, big anxiety because they're getting this artificial food and they all have to scramble for it.
Ah.
That would be my suggestion.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks a lot, Daniel, for that question. 1-300-800-222 if you have a question for Gráinne about birds. Anne, in Randwick, evening to you, Anne.
Hi, Indira. And Gráinne, I have a question, but can I share an observation first?
Oh, gotcha.
I live in a one-bedroom unit and there are no trees, but the lorikeets live in a little crevice in the roof and they come and eat honey for breakfast on my balcony and other foods. But they always come in pairs and they talk when they're eating, but when they rest, they keep quiet.
Yeah.
But they're really interesting the way they have to do everything together. It's two of them or none of them.
Yeah, that's absolutely. So part of that is mirroring each other's behavior. And it's something we do when we have been with our partner for a long time and been very intimate with one individual. We often, you know, we will copy each other's behavior. Birds are the same. They're incredibly social. And one way, so this is probably a pair that have been together for years and will stay together throughout the year. So part of them doing everything together is reaffirming their bond the whole time. So when they're having their honey, they'll be going, oh, yeah, this is lovely. Gorgeous. Oh, yeah, loving this. Just reaffirming with each other that they're having a good time. And yet when they go off and they sleep and they're very close together, they know that this is the resting time and they'll both rest together. But it is part of living with another individual long time and for a happy, harmonious relationship is to be able to get on with the other person and being able to nearly, you know, know what they're going to do next and be able to sink in your behaviour with them.
Mm. So, Anne, what's your question for Gráinne?
My question is, why do birds generally have a pharynx and not a larynx as humans do?
Okay, so that's got to do with singing. That's got to do with how it's been developed and it's how they make the noises and the amazing songs, especially the songbirds like the magpies. So not all birds have it as developed as a great mimicker like the magpie, but it's just the way that, yeah, it's just their evolution and how it sits in their chest is different to ours. So it allows them to produce different notes together and make those fantastic songs we hear.
Mm. Thanks for that question, Anne. Alex from Melbourne, hello to you.
G'day, how are you?
Yeah, good, thanks, Alex. What's your question?
My question's not really a question. It's I'm just letting people know that with the hooded plover, they like make a nest out in the open. But where I am, I can see them. They nest on the roof of a basketball court.
Okay. Is that the usual thing, Alec? Gráinne?
No. Okay. So when you say that, what do you mean? Where are they nesting? I didn't understand.
On top of the roof of a basketball court.
The hooded plover doesn't normally. It makes a nest out in the open.
Oh, but exactly.
These ones are doing it on the roof of the basketball court, which is it's big indoor basketball court.
That's brilliant. It's almost mimicking. it's mimicking the natural environment, which would be that open area on the ground. It's just moving onto the roof to do it. But the main point of the plover is to be able to see around him, to be able to have a good view of any predators around him. So that's an adaptation. When they're on the ground, they get stressed out by cats, they get stressed out by people, by dogs, by people walking their dogs. If that bird can adapt to the roof of a flat roof on a basketball court, yeah, it could do, and it would still be able to watch out for predators. That's brilliant.
Thanks for that observation, Alex, in Melbourne. This, I'm sure we're going to get a number of questions along these lines, Gráinne. This mm-hmm. question is a cry for help. How do I get a butcher bird to stop swooping me? It has hit me in the head twice this week at my front door.
Okay, so this is a little bit controversial, but it is the best thing to do. So as long as I take it, I trust that you're not tormenting the bird. I trust that you're not out there with a stick going, get away from me. As long as you're being good to that bird, you might just want to introduce yourself to him. So when the butcher bird is around, like on your doorstep, when you go outside, put down a little bit of meat. Just put down a little bit of minced meat. Introduce yourself to the bird. Let the bird know that you've put down a bit of food. You're making peace. You want to say, Jesus, leave me alone. I just want to walk out my front door. And this might help the bird make friends with you. It's something worth trying. Try it on a couple of occasions because they can be loyal to the area they're in and it can be hard to move them.
Right. Have you tried that and it's worked, Gráinne?
I've heard of it. I've never been swooped.
You've never been swooped?
God, except so I live for two giraffes. I swear to God, and I don't mean that in any kind of metaphor, actual two birds. And when they're flying around my kitchen first thing in the morning and I'm trying to have my cup of tea, the bloody giraffe will swoop me. So yes, I've been swooped by my own pet birds, but never a bird outside.
And as Gráinne was saying, we're very lucky in Australia that we still have, you know, larger birds around us that we can interact with. And some of the questions I've been thinking about when it comes to, you know, birds. So, for instance, ibises, which are terribly sometimes referred to as bin chickens. Now, I've been fascinated by the ibises around my area in King's Cross in Sydney, Gráinne, because they are birds from water, you know, wetlands that are used to nesting in reeds. And there's a group of ibises that have started nesting in the top of these palm trees in our square. And it's fascinating how they've adapted to the urban environment. Now, how does a bird, I mean, I suppose they just figure out we're not going to find any wetlands here. So what's the closest to it? The tops of palm trees are sort of like wetland reeds.
Well, exactly. So what's happening there is a few. So the ibises, again, you know, we've got to take a lot of responsibility for what we've done to the habitats of the birds over here. And the ibis, as you said, is a wetland bird. And he's a good example of the plight of the wetland birds because they don't often get a look in and they're losing their habitat at a tremendous rate. And when they kind of go exploring, looking for new habitats, Taronga Zoo was, you know, we knew that they were declining, started introducing a few into the city and kind of really taught them how to live in the city. They were brought up, these ibises were brought up city smart. So when other ibises were flying over, they would spot the other ibises and go, hang on, they're living in this new area. If they can live here, they can find food, they can nest, then surely I can. So birds will copy each other, they'll watch each other. And what works for one bird, the other bird will try. So that's how we get this influx of ibises in the city. A lot of them were self-introduced from its natural habitat, which it was losing. So it's a great example, as I said, of this wetland bird with this long beak and how it's been able to adapt. And not only that, they'll actually, during wet season, when it's very rainy, as it happened up in Sydney there a few months ago, the ibises all went to Hyde Park, went all to the parks, hanging out in the rain, eating all the worms that would come to the surface. But it started behaving like a wetland bird again once, you know, Sydney turned into a wetland. So it is really fascinating about how when the food is right and the weather is right, they will switch to more natural food. So they're not always the bin chicken. They're, you know, they're not always living off our waste. They will take natural food as well.
Yeah, well, I do a walk through the Botanic Gardens a couple times a week. And I've noticed that, yes, as you said, when it rains, the ibis all gather around under the trees in the Botanic Gardens. And I've seen them, you know, put their beaks, I think that they, you know, that they're putting their beaks almost in the soil. But then I was reading about how ibises have the sonar in the tip of their beaks, and that's how they detect the movement of worms.
Yeah, so that's it. But they will put their beaks in to kind of find out where the worm is, and then we'll go much further down to actually get the worm out. So, yeah, and the soil, of course, is nice and wet, and the earthworms will come to the surface to stop them getting waterlogged. Another thing we see is the seagulls. So I've seen this in Aberdeen, Scotland. I've seen it in Trinity College, Dublin, and I've seen it in Sydney University. So this is how much I've seen this. It's seagulls on grass or on, you know, a lawn, and they'll be doing this little dance. They'll be tapping their feet. And if you watch, they're tapping their feet. What are they doing? They are actually stimulating the sound of raindrops on the soil. So the earthworms will be like, oh, no, it's raining. Better get up to the surface. And there's your seagull ready to eat, ready to take it. So that's an adaptation that has been seen in different countries. And the same birds are using the same mechanism to get at these worms. Just brilliant. Wildlife ecology. It's awesome.
Yeah, that is. Speaking of seagulls, I've often wondered, you know, at our, you know, beach and water areas where tourists gather, seagulls gather and, you know, they get bits of food from our plate and people throw them chips. Those seagulls, do they actually do any fishing for fish or do they mix it around or do they just sort of scavenge from people?
So what's happened there is this whole idea of seagull, the word sea is something we very much call them. The seagull, you know, I'm just going to say for easier, but the gull never once, you know, wanted to be 100% committed to the sea. Yeah. It's a very adaptable species. And because, again, of us overfishing, we're taking their food. So there's a huge now competitiveness for the fish that is left. So a lot of seagulls are like, Jesus, this is getting too hard. The fish is all gone. You know, we're not guaranteed food. We have to go somewhere else. So they turn around and look at us. And you'll often see them around bins, or sorry, around tips, around rubbish dumps. And one of the key factors that makes seagulls so adaptable is that they're able to regurgitate the food they eat. So they eat a load of plastic, but they eat some good food and then they eat another load of plastic. They can take the good food and then regurgitate up the plastic. So they, you know, they're just perfect. Yeah, they are scavengers. They are perfect for that. But that's not a derogatory term. It just shows how well they've adapted because we are taking their fish. They've moved inland. We've seen them in Orange. Orange, miles away from the sea. But it just shows that they are moving more inland as we take their fish. We live in Australia. I say this, if you want mammals, go to Africa. We don't have much in Europe. But if you want birds, come to Australia. You know, this is the country of birds, and birds will bite you back. You know, they're not going to go quietly. They've been in this country for a bleeding long time. So, you know, we're learning to live with them is just so important. And we've seen, like, here in Melbourne, we have falcons in the CBD, you know, and it's this war of falcons killing each other over the city centre. You know, and it's like, you know, dragons in the air, because peregrine falcons are incredibly loyal to their nest. And the only way you're going to get a male to leave his territory is by death. So they actually fight to the death. So at the moment, we have a new male displacing the female and are displacing the resident male. So this new male is, you know, sizing up, trying to chase and kill this first male. And it's just all going on. And we're watching on Facebook and there's a live feed showing what's happening. And it's just fascinating the way people are watching these birds all night and all day and watching their antics and what they're getting up to. It's just, yeah, they're incredible.
Yeah, I love your passion, Gráinne. This is fabulous. I love how you're so into birds. I just want to pick up that point you mentioned, Gráinne, about how Australia is the place. If you love birds, if you want to observe birds, you come here. Do you think most Australians are aware of that? Do you think we take our bird life for granted?
Oh, I love this country. And I should mention, I've written another book called Your Backyard Birds that came out a couple of years ago. So this is my second book. And it is that passion people have for their birds that, yes, they do appreciate it because they see how damn intelligent they are. Like the big war going on with the cockatoos in Sydney, opening up the bins and people trying to outsmart them. And the cockatoos outsmarting the people. And it's this like arms race going on between who's going to win as the cockatoos continue to be more, you know, more being more in taking more initiative and finding out how to open the bins. And I think, and especially with the magpie, I think people are beginning to realize that, yeah, they've got some pretty damn special birds here. And I see that a lot when people email me about how much they love their birds.
Mm. Oh, well, that's good because, you know, when it comes to birds like the ibis, I guess that's a pretty large bird to find in a city centre. Because when I travel through Europe and America, there are only these tiny little sparrows and things. And I think we sometimes can take that for granted that we are privileged to have such large animals, such large birds sharing our cities with us. Gráinne, you know, as I said, why do birds sing in the morning? Maybe you can help us with the answer to that.
I will, but just before I jump into that one, the one about the tree eyelid. So what they have is a nictitating membrane, which is an eyelid that is semi-transparent. So when you see a little fairy wren and it's going flying through the bush, you know, 90 miles an hour, and you're like, oh, Jesus, how does it not hit something or how does it not get something in his eye? This is the membrane that protects the eye. The same thing is when you have birds diving under the water. How can they still see? It's this nictitating membrane that they use. But on your others, so I thought that was really good. See, that's this book. I know you asked me that question, but just to back up, how I even thought about this book was I do this show on ABC Canberra once a week with Lish Fea. It's called Good Things Come in Trees. And every week the callers would come to me and ask me a question. And a lot of the time I'd just be like, oh, I know the answer to that. But being a good researcher, I always made myself do the research the day before. And I would go on the show to answer the question. And I would always find something new. And I would always go, God, I didn't know that. I thought I knew everything. So that's one thing about the book. It's like even I a lot of time go, wow, I never knew that. And it was always full of surprises. So people would phone me, you know, every week I'd get a question and I started writing them all down. And when I was thinking about book two, so my first book was very much, you know, citizen science stories that I helped to explain and tips on what to do in your back garden with birds. This book then, you know, I was thinking, oh, urban ecology, and it's like, oh, it's so depressing, you know, oh God, you know, we're all going to, you know, urban ecology, all the wildlife's going to be dead, all depressing. And I was like, no, I didn't get into this to be negative. I got into what I do to be positive and show the people, you know, the wonders of what they see in their own back garden. So I started looking through these questions and answers. And I was like, oh, my God, this could be a book here. I could put these all in a book. And that's what I did. And that's how I got that many questions. And how they all came about was from this show I did every week. So it just goes to show, you know, no matter how much we think we know things, there's always something new to learn.
That's true. You're listening to Indira and I Do on Nightlife. And the very passionate Dr. Gráinne Cleary is with me. She's an Irish wildlife ecologist and a research fellow at Deakin University. She's written a book called Why Birds Do That, based on many of the questions that listeners have been sending into her when she did her show in Canberra. Before I take the next call, can we go back to the why birds sing in the morning?
So this is a great question, and it goes back to a few months ago when I had a lot of people phoning me or email me going, why is the magpie singing at 3 a.m? Why is a bleeding magpie awake? Does it not know it's the middle of the night? And this had a lot to do with, think about the time of the year. We have been coming out of a dark winter, but we've had very bright moons. But when the magpies will sleep in the trees, and they'll often sleep in trees with no foliage, especially during the winter. So the moon is very bright and the magpies will often wake up and they're like, well, I'm awake, so I might as well practice my song. So this will often, you know, this is one of the theories. Again, you can never say 100% for sure this is what's happening. But what we think is that the birds are actually practicing their song. So when the dawn comes along, when it's the dawn chorus, they've already warmed up that vocal chorus. They're already warmed up and ready to blast it out. Now, there's other ideas that maybe the magpies are singing to their eggs and letting them, the eggs, recognise the call. But we're not, we don't know too much about that because we don't know when there was a male or female singing. But to go back to the dawn chorus, why they sing first thing in the morning, this is something we see a lot in Europe. And it's got to do with smaller birds being awake early in the morning. They would have just foraged just before dawn. And then dawn comes and they sing to mark their territory. This is my territory. I'm still here. I'm still alive after this very cold night. So that's why you really hear them go. But in Australia and in the UK and in America, it's usually the male birds that sing. And we always thought it was because the female couldn't sing or it doesn't sing. But then you come to Australia, lo and behold, you have male and female birds both singing. So we think that when they sing in the morning, especially in Australia, they're marking their territory, but they're also coming together as a family because a lot of our birds live in family groups. They retain the young from last year to help at the nest, help mom and dad raise their young. We see this in white-winged coughs a lot as well. And part, and in the magpie, part of the bonding is this caroling we hear first thing in the morning. Same with the kookaburras. You're having a good sing song together. You're all joining in. You're all reaffirming that bond before you spend the day out there getting food, doing what you need to do.
Alex in Waverley. Hello to you, Alex.
Yes. I'm good. Thank you. Hello. I adore Dr. Clary. She's a brilliant communicator and obviously extremely erudite. I have a question about birds singing because I sing to my birds and I've been singing, whistling to them for years and they know me and they respond to me, kookaburras, magpies and butcher birds. Do they recognize humans singing? I do the same type of song for different types of, I have a different song for different types of birds. Do you know if there's been any studies of human communications with birds? I live in Sydney.
That this is a brilliant question, and I love this question. And this is people like you. You know, you're the citizen scientist out there calling sniffing birds and having those birds sing back to you. Yes. How do I know it works? Because I do the bleeding same, and so does my husband. As I said earlier, we live with two glass, and they'll make a lot of noise. And we live with a lot of the miners, the Indian miners in particular, will hear my husband whistling back, and they'll actually whistle the song back to my husband. So yes, this does happen, but we don't have an awful lot of it in the science literature because it can be quite a difficult study, and also that's just not enough money, not enough resources. But yes, I really believe they do, especially songbirds like the butcher bird, like the magpie, and even like the kookaburra. They're very territorial. They'll be the same birds you see every day. And yes, they do recognise you. And you're the lovely lady that talks to them. And yes, they do talk back to you. I totally believe that. I've had so much evidence of people sending me in their magpie chatting back to them. Can I just share one story from, this is my last book, Your Backyard Birds. I had this one woman, she came in to visit her mother, and her mother's having this conversation. Oh, hello, Judy. I'm loving to see you, Judy. How are you? And the daughter says, who are you talking to, ma'am? She comes in, the man's talking to the magpie, and the magpie's whistling back at her. So, yes, brilliant.
Thanks for that question.
Funny, one time I was in my backyard whistling to the birds, and I heard my neighbors next door saying, gosh, that's a beautiful bird. I've never heard that before, and it was me. I can sing really beautifully. I can sing Beethoven. I can whistle Beethoven and do funny things with my voice and my whistle. So I can, birds all know me in the area, so it's
Alex,
really wonderful. I just love it. Thanks, anyway.
Alex, do a whistle for us.
Something like that. I can do very
really
elaborate
good.
Things. I can do very elaborate things. But I just love the birds since I came to Australia. I'm just like in love with them.
Oh,
thank
lovely.
You for your work. It's very important. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Alex. So that was a really good whistle, wasn't it, Gráinne?
Oh, that was brilliant. And people like her, she just makes my day. That's exactly it. People have such passion for the birds.
Yeah. Karen in Perth. Hello to you, Karen. Hello, Karen. Are you there? No, we don't have Karen yet. That's all right. Let's go to Thane in Marrickville. Hello, Thane.
Oh, yes. Good evening. Yeah, it's the Indian miners, you know, which I dislike greatly. But we have a lot of them here in Marrickville, and they wake me every morning. But their call is very complicated, and they can go like tick, 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 tock, and then trill, and then wobble, and they keep doing it in a certain pattern. And I'm wondering, is it, you know, has anyone ever worked out the language? What are they actually saying? This is my territory, or I'm looking for a mate, or...
I love that question. Absolutely love that question. So first of all, Indian miners, as you know, came from the continent of India, and they were actually introduced as aviary birds because they're great mimics. They are beautiful pet birds, and they'll just mimic you. So what you're hearing is that makeup of complex songs, different notes, is very common of a bird that mimics. It will be listening to different notes in the environment. And a lot of the time it's just practicing. Or it can be, you know, when it's being more aggressive, it can be marking territory or driving away prey. But a lot of time, they're just kind of singing to each other. Now, birds don't use, now what we do know about their communication, they don't use a lot of nouns or adjectives. They use a lot of verbs, food, water. So like when they're eating and they're chirping to each other, it was just kind of like, yeah, yummy, yummy, yummy. So that's the thing about, you know, us primates, we are very vocal. And, you know, we talk a lot and we share gossip. And that's a complex society. Birds are the same. They're just as complex as us. And they talk to each other. And they'll just, you know, just do these little communications back and forth. And then a bird will add another little bit of the song. And its mate will try to copy it and they'll add on. Our birds at the moment, our galahs, we're teaching them Irish. So we're teaching them Dia Gwit, which is hello. And now that's their war song. So it's that flying around my head first thing in the morning in my kitchen as I'm having my cup of tea. They go, Dia Gwit! Dia Gwit! And it's just like, oh my gosh, you two are hilarious. So yeah, they definitely pick up songs and will use those focals in ways of communicating with each other.
We're answering any question you may have about birds on Nightlife tonight. With us is Dr. Gráinne Cleary. She's an Irish wildlife ecologist, and she's written a book called Why Birds Do That. It's packed with answers to all the most common questions that we have about birds. But Milton in Young, good evening to you. Hello, Milton.
Yes, hello.
What's your question?
My question is, I was wondering why cockatoos, galahs, major Mitchells and the likes of that pluck their feathers out of their chest and actually pluck themselves bald. I was just wondering
why they do that.
Is that because of a boredom or...?
That's something we see in captivity. Now, that's not something we would see in the wild. If that's something in the wild, that would be something like beacon feather disease, but that doesn't cause them to actually pluck them out. So what you're talking about there is if they're in captivity, yes, that is boredom. These birds are incredibly intelligent. They need, like these two galahs I have, it's like I don't have children. I have birds. And it's like only toddlers. They constantly have to be supervised because they're into everything, because they're so intelligent and because they're so social. So the worst thing you can do is get one of these, like the Sulfies or the Major Michelins or the Galahs, and then keep them separate, keep them on their own. They need to be out of the cage. If you don't have it with another individual and you just have it as a pet on its own, it will need a lot of your attention to keep its mental health happy. And if you do have it with another individual, that can alleviate some of the plucking. But yeah, it's usually a signal of distress and it not being a happy bird.
All right. Thanks for that question, Milton. Jill from Mount Nelson, Gráinne, has this question. Do birds such as sparrows return to the same nests each year? Should we leave the nests in the trees when we find them?
Yeah, absolutely do. So a big thing about a bird is where it's going to nest. Will that nest survive? If I lay my eggs in it, will it survive a big storm that might come through or high winds? And if that nest does survive, they will often come back to it, or they might have to even chase out some other birds. Birds like sparrows, they don't live that long. They'll only usually live about 3 years, maybe. But birds like our magpies, who stay in the same territory and we know live up to 14 years, will definitely stay with the same nest, because that nest has proven to be really stable.
Wow. Come back for 14 years. That's extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, they can do. And same with the cockatoos. If the nest has survived, they will show fertility to us. Fertility to that nest site.
All right. Another question in Melbourne, this one is. This listener, John, wants to know, Melbourne's willy wagtails, they seem to have disappeared in recent years.
Yeah, I've seen that as well. So I also live in Melbourne, and I live in an area in Richmond, right beside the footy. The whole city went quiet once the footy started, and once the Cats started winning, oh my God, you could hear a pin drop. But anyway, we don't have many willy wagtails, but on the occasions I've seen them, they've been in this one particular garden beside this one particular tree. A couple of weeks ago, the tree was cut down. The willy wagtails are gone. They ain't coming back. So what we can do in our back garden, what our neighbours do, can really affect the birds that persist around our area. And I do think we are losing our willy wagtails because we're losing a lot of our native vegetation. So, yeah, they're down, and they're a bird we really want to keep in our urban environment. You know, a great messenger bird of the Aboriginals. You know, when you see a willy wagtail, somebody's talking about you, has a message for you. So, yeah, it's a bird we do need to keep. So keep your native vegetation.
Yes, important. 12-year-old Lila is with us from Gunning. Hello, Lila. How are you?
Hi, I'm good.
Good. What's your question for Gronya?
Why do roosters have spurs at the back of their feet?
Why do roosters have feathers on the back of their feet?
Spurs.
Spurs. So that's for fighting. So roosters are very aggressive. There can only be one rooster in a house of hens. So those roosters really need to fight each other. And one of the ways they fight each other is to use the back of the foot to injure the other bird. So that spur is actually a weapon that the rooster will use when it's trying to defend the hens from another individual.
Do you keep chickens, Lila, at your home?
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. So you've seen these spurs?
Yeah.
Yeah. And have you seen the roosters use them to, you know, defend themselves and fight off other chickens? No.
Can they fight snakes?
Can they fight snakes, Gronya?
They can fight snakes. So if you look at a rooster, they've got very long legs, and they'll often use those long legs and those feet to pin down the snake. So, yeah, they can. And it's their job to protect the hens. So it's very important that they do defend them. But did you know that hens have taste buds? Did you know hens can taste really sour food? So the next time you look at your hens and you see them eating, just think they can actually taste what they're eating just the way we can.
Right. And so that's unusual for a bird, is it, Gronya?
Well, it's something we didn't know. It's when you think about, now I'm going to talk about birds like the hens. There's been research done on chickens. They actually found out they have 350 taste buds. So we have around 10,000, and a cow has up to 20,000 taste buds. Now, why a cow needs 20,000 taste buds, I don't know. But birds have about 350, but it's not on their tongue the way we have it. It's actually back in their oral cavity. So this leads us to believe that they do use their tongue like another finger to kind of manipulate food and root around in food, but actually taste it further back in their mouths.
There you go. Well, Lila, you can maybe test that out with giving your chicken some lemon or something and see if they pull a face if it's too sour. Thanks for your call, Lila.
No problem.
Okay, bye-bye. Oh, that was adorable. What else do we have coming through here? Here's Karen from Perth. Let's see if we can get her back. Hello, Karen.
Hello, can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Oh, good. I just wanted to know, apart from the obvious answer that they're playing, why, I can't remember now whether it was magpies or crows that would get on top of the apex of our garage roof and pick up stones and just drop them on the apex and see which side they'd fall down. And then they'd do it again, and they were taking it in turns, and there was about six to eight of them doing it.
Yep. So what they were doing was playing exactly what you said, and crows do it and also the magpies do it. So you might have had juveniles. So these would have been young birds, you know, they can sustain themselves. They're still hanging around with other young individuals. They're not ready to mate. So they're exploring the environment they're in. And the environment happens to include your house. And they love the sound of it. And even watching the stones fall down would give them a real, like, would be real curious to them. My two galahs, feeding them in the morning, they'll throw the dishes down on the ground just to listen to it bang, just to watch it. They're really curious and they want to try different things and see what happens when they do this. So, yeah, and working together in groups and, you know, watching each other doing it, and then everybody has to have a go to make sure everyone can do it. Wonderful, just wonderful.
So much fun. Great question, Karen. 1300 800 222. If you have a question for Gráinne, there's a question here about noisy miners, Gráinne. They peck incessantly at mirrors and chrome parts of cars. Tony and Lorne wants to know why.
Yeah, so this is a great question. We also see this in Willy Wagtails a lot, and it's usually the male that does it, and it's usually during the breeding season when the male is full of testosterone and is feeling very, you know, fighty and, you know, I hate saying the word aggressive, but there's no other word for it. But I don't mean aggressive kind of in a bad way. I'm kind of, you know, it's just all wound up. So when it sees its reflection in a car in a car mirror, it thinks it's another individual. Because from a bird's point of view, the bird is used to seeing its reflection when it looks down at the water and it has a drink. But the bird doesn't expect to meet one at eye level. So when it does see the bird in the mirror, it does think it's another individual and will continue to fight with it. And especially when it's during breeding season and they're all being territorial and all trying to keep their territory, they're more likely to display this behaviour because they get mixed up and think it is actually another individual.
All right. Thank you, Julie in Cremorne. Thanks for your patience, Julie. What's your question?
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm really enjoying listening to you and Gráinne in India.
Yeah, great.
Look, I've actually observed that behaviour with an eastern magpie lark in a car park. It was into my external rear vision mirror. It spent the whole afternoon there admiring itself. But I really was ringing up about the sulphur-crested cockatoos. We lived in Canberra for a period of time and we were opposite an office building with a flat roof, and they used to line up on the – I'd hear all this squawking. The cockatoos would be up there in a row and they'd play 10 in the bed and the middle one said, roll over, and they would push the end one off. He'd squawk loudly and fly around and join the end of the queue. And then they'd all start rocking back and forth, and then they'd do the big push again. And they'd keep this up all afternoon. It was so raucous. But what we have here in Cremorne, we've got a big back balcony where all the cockatoos assemble to prune our plants. They do a wonderful job. They create a terrible mess. But yesterday we noticed one who had a number tag on his wing, or her wing, I suppose. It was 103, so we got on the internet and looked it up, and its name is Tobruk. It likes to frequent Mossman, Rushcutters Bay and Cremorne. And we discovered there are hundreds of these birds, and they've all got names like Lady Gaga. And anyway, I'm just wondering how we get in touch. Would it be the Sydney Museum?
So this, I know exactly what you're talking about. And again, this goes back to citizen science. So cockatoos are such conspicuous birds. You can't help but, you know, see them. So what's going on here is Taronga Zoo has this initiative where they're looking at the dispersal of the cockatoos around Sydney. So you want to go to John Martin, and you'll find him at the Taronga Zoo website. He's the one looking after this wing tag, I think they call it. And yeah, you can report where you've seen that bird, and they'll then say, yeah, it's still visiting Cremorne, and they can see how they're interacting with each other and how they're watching each other and how they're learning from each other. And it's a really, really good initiative, and it's a great program to be involved in. So you Sydneysiders, especially around those areas that lady just talked about, watch out for your cockatoos with these yellow number tags on their wings.
All right. Thanks for that question, Julie. And we've got a little bit of time left, Gráinne. A question here from Bernadette about the pair of peregrine falcons that reside at Collins Street in Melbourne. Are they the same pair that come each year?
So this is a brilliant question, and I'm going to be talking about this during the week again. So what's happened this year is we have a new female. Since I think... I've got it written down, but I can't find it. But I think since 2017, 2018, it's been the same pair. But this year, the female died and the male took a new female.
Ah.
And because there's a new female, there's a new male floating around going, hang on, there's disruption in the force. Something's not happy. This is a new marriage. Let's see, can I get in here and can I take this valuable piece of real estate?
And that's causing this fighting you were talking about earlier in the skies.
That's what's causing the fighting earlier on, yeah. And if they fight to the death. So these birds, just very quickly, do very well in urban areas because they nest on cliff faces. So ledges of buildings mimic a cliff face. So big birds like peregrine falcons can adapt well to urban to cities, especially. But it's important not to poison your pigeons or poison your rats, because then the peregrine falcons could take these sick birds, take the rat and feed on it and feed their young. So it you know, this is where we have birds doing what they should do, controlling other populations. Let's keep it natural.
Yeah, that's a very good point to remind us about. Gráinne, it's been fantastic having you on Nightlife. Just absolutely adore your passion and your knowledge, and so have our listeners. So sorry we couldn't get to all the questions people were sending through, but we got through quite a few. Gráinne, thank you. Your book is called Why Birds Do That. It comes out in October. More than 50 questions you get stuck into there get people the answers to them. Thank you. And I look forward to talking to you soon again on the show, Gráinne.
I would love to be back. This was so much fun.
Yeah, it was good. Dr. Gráinne Cleary, who's an Irish wildlife ecologist.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.